Want to create your own natural holiday oasis? Well, we've got the answer. Avocado Green Mattress products transform your home into a peaceful grounding retreat. They're made with certified organic and sustainably sourced materials. Avocado is better for you, better for the planet. From breathable bedding to handcrafted mattresses, Avocado is all about true comfort, so you can rest, recharge, and wake up refreshed all season long. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, just a big thank you to everyone who reviewed us on Apple. We really appreciate it. It actually does help with the algorithm. And if you haven't done so yet, please rate and review us. It actually brings the show to more people, has us show up and recommended and things like that. So please take the time to do that. And if you haven't yet, please consider subscribing. We've got some really good bonus episodes coming up that I want everyone to hear with, you know, big names like Mike Duncan, Alex Savinia, all of your favorites. So if you haven't yet, please sign up and subscribe to the podcast. All right, Derek, let's get into it. And let's start with these Iran negotiations. And they surprisingly seem to be going well.
Well, it depends on who you ask. Donald Trump on Friday, or rather on Sunday, rather, the talks were on Friday. The fifth round of negotiations between the U.S. and Iran took place in Rome in the Omani embassy, mediated again by Omani officials, including their foreign minister, Badr al-Busaidi. Trump characterized them over the weekend as very, very good. He said they had made real progress, serious progress, and as far as I can tell, nobody really seems to know what he's talking about. I mean, they've made some progress. I don't want to discount what's happened, but I wouldn't necessarily call it serious progress. Trump also said, this was on Sunday, that he was expecting he might have some good news to announce on the Iran front in the next 2 days. And we're now 4 days after he said that, and there's been no announcement of any good news on the Iran front. You know, I think he may have jumped the gun a little bit, but of course, because he's the president of the United States, anything he says makes waves. Again, I don't want to discount that there's been some progress. Busaidi, the Omani foreign minister, said that the negotiations had made some progress, but not conclusive progress, which I think is the more realistic way of looking at this. I've seen reporting over the last couple of days suggesting that the U.S. and Iran may be close to announcing. They'll frame it as an agreement. It's really more of a statement of principles that suggests, in terms of the overall picture, they want to create the impression, at least, that they're on the same page, that they've come to some general agreements on the terms of the negotiations. Really, this is the kind of thing that signifies just basically that you intend to keep talking. There's not much more to it than that. But it's not an insignificant thing if they're able to do that. It will probably take another round of negotiations, and I don't think that's been scheduled yet. So it'll probably take a sixth round of talks before they're ready to issue something like that. And then really, the real work will begin at that point, where you've got to do all the technical details and put something together into an actual plan with actual measurable, deliverable goals and requirements on both sides. That's all yet to be done, and that's the real heavy lifting. In the meantime, though, what this is all supposed to forestall, or at least I think Trump would like to forestall, is an Israeli military strike against Iranian nuclear facilities. We've talked about this and before, that the Israelis are sort of watching how these negotiations go and looking for an opening to take action against Iranian nuclear facilities. And they've been told by Trump, and Trump confirmed this on Wednesday, that he's told Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, directly not to carry out a military strike on Iranian nuclear facilities. He said he had a phone call with Netanyahu last week, and he didn't characterize it as an order or a warning, but he told reporters that he said, "I don't think it's appropriate right now for Israel to take that kind of action." The Israelis could always attempt something like this on their own. I don't think they could pull it off. It's different, you know. It's a bit more difficult to strike these hardened nuclear facilities, and to do so with the capacity to cause any real damage than, you know, some of the attacks they've attempted on Iran, or they've made on Iran in the past several months, that were just sort of general attacks on, you know, air defense or radar sites or military sites. That's a little less challenging than what they would be trying to attempt with these nuclear sites. And I don't know that they could pull it off without considerable U.S. support. And Trump seems not to be willing to provide it, at least for the time being, as long as he thinks there's a deal to be had. So in that sense, whatever they can announce here, I guess, is a positive thing if it indicates some progress and sort of backs the Israelis off a bit. There's also been reporting that Trump got an earful during his recent trip to the Persian Gulf from the Arab Gulf leaders that he interacted with in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE, all of them really urging him not to allow the Israelis to make any attack on Iran. They fear, rightly, I think, being caught in the crossfire in the event of something like that sparking a regional war. And they're not terribly interested in it right now. If you had done this, you know, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, that you probably would have gotten a different response from the Arab Gulf states, at least from the UAE and Saudi Arabia. But right now, they're definitely not interested in any sort of aggression toward Iran, any sort of regional conflict like that, and certainly not on behalf of the Israelis, who, you know, they're struggling to maintain even basic relationships with, given the popular outrage over what's happening in Gaza.
Well, speaking of the Israelis, let's move to Israel-Palestine, and let's begin with this new aid program that has come online but has not had the effects that one might have hoped.
The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, this is the scheme that the Trump administration devised with Israel to shift the burden or shift the responsibility for distributing humanitarian aid away from the United Nations and international relief organizations to this privatized corporate mercenary outfit, basically, that set up a foundation of sorts in it's registered in Switzerland, although Swiss authorities are already challenging its legal basis. Apparently, there's been some claims that the foundation is not sticking to the rules for foundations that are registered in Switzerland. So that may be a challenge to overcome moving forward. But in the meantime, its work got underway on Monday. This was one day after the person who had been hired to run it as its executive director, a man named Jake Wood, who's a former U.S. Marine, served in Iraq and Afghanistan, quit, alleging, at least, that it was clear. Let me just read his quote here. "It's clear that it is not possible to implement this plan while also strictly adhering to the humanitarian principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence," which he said he would not abandon. Clearly a shot, I think, at the way this has been structured by Israel, primarily along with the compliance of the Trump administration. The scheme, as we've talked about before, it involves setting up distribution hubs in the southern part of Gaza, where specific individuals identified, biometrically screened, in theory at least, designated by the authorities, the Israeli authorities or the GHF or whoever is supposed to be ultimately in charge of this, as the proper recipients for their households or their families, would be obliged to go to one of these facilities, which right away is basically a vehicle for forced displacement of Palestinians from other parts of Gaza. You're forcing them to go to the south, to what's left of Rafah, to collect this stuff. Then they would be screened, as I said. The screening process, based on what we know of it, is particularly troubling. As I said, it's biometrics, so I guess facial recognition or some other form of screening in that fashion, which leaves open the possibility that aid could be either, you know, politicized, and you know, certain people could be rejected if they've, you know, done something or said something to alienate the Israeli government, or that it could be weaponized. You could have people lured in, basically, who are wanted, or that the Israeli government would like to disappear, could be lured in with the promise of collecting aid, and then, you know, something would happen to them. They'd be abducted. What we've already seen over the last few days is that this group, the GHF, is not ready for prime time. There were at least two incidents over Tuesday and Wednesday, I believe, where crowds of people, the facilities were just not set up to handle the crush of people who would be coming to, who were coming to you know, collect aid. Staffers had to kind of fall back and leave the distribution nodes empty, and the Israeli military fired what they called warning shots. I don't see how that's possible, because they killed at least 10 people across two different distribution nodes where incidents like this happened, and wounded dozens more with gunshot fire, with gunshot wounds. That doesn't seem like warning shots to me, but you know, I guess your mileage may vary on that front. So yeah, it hasn't been a great rollout pretty much across the board, and there remain deep concerns about how this thing is being run that are, you know, preventing or have discouraged the UN and you know, these other groups from working with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And as I said, even the ex-Marine director of the group resigned over those concerns. So I think a lot of things to be worried about here.
Let's talk about these truce discussions. There's been a lot of he said, she said, Derek. So what really happened?
There is news on the ceasefire front. Over the weekend, Steve Witkoff, the White House Trump administration envoy to the ceasefire negotiations between Hamas and Israel, proposed a new framework for a ceasefire that Hamas reportedly accepted. The Israelis rejected, and then Witkoff turned around and blamed Hamas for wrecking the deal. This has become the pattern, was the pattern for the Biden administration, has become the pattern for the Trump administration. But Witkoff told reporters on Wednesday that he was going to submit a new, what he called a term sheet, basically another framework, different language for a deal. And the reporting now, as we're recording this, is that a deal may be imminent, that the Israeli government has already assented to it. Hamas, the last I saw, was issuing statements saying it was still looking at the language and still deliberating, although there have been reports very recently from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's Al Arabiya television network apparently reporting that Hamas has accepted this new framework from Witkoff. The terms have been published at Dropsite, friend of the show, Dropsite News, and they basically sound like the same framework that Witkoff proposed over the weekend, but heavily watered down to accommodate the Israeli government's desire not to end the massacre in Gaza until it has ethnically cleansed the territory. So where there was strong language, apparently, in what Hamas agreed to over the weekend, or what it announced on Monday that it agreed to, rather, where there was strong language on a temporary ceasefire, partial captive exchange leading to a permanent long-term ceasefire, hudna, as Hamas refers to it, the Arabic term for a long-term ceasefire, a withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip, very specific language about an increase in aid and how that would be managed, the appointment of a sort of day after committee to run Gaza. All of that has been really watered down to basically like some vague pronouncements that the U.S. government really thinks these two sides should continue to negotiate in good faith until they come to a final agreement, and guarantees on the part of the U.S. and the other the mediators, Egypt and Qatar, that the initial ceasefire lease, which looks like a 60-day ceasefire, as it's been the whole time, 10 captives being released, 10 captives in Gaza being released, some unspecified number of Palestinians in Israeli custody being released, that would be guaranteed. And then there's also apparently a clause covering any agreed upon extensions, which is something the Israelis might be interested in after the 60 days is up, as long as they're temporary extensions. But there's nothing in here that would hold Israel's feet to the fire or sort of, you know, put pressure on the Israeli government to actually agree to an end to the war. So what you're looking at is another potentially 60-day ceasefire, 60-day truce, after which the massacre, the starvation, all of these things would probably resume again, with a commitment or the intense desire on the part of Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government to get to Donald Trump's ethnic cleansing plan or to implement that eventually. So, you know, it accommodates the Israeli government's interest in just not stopping this until they finish cleansing the territory. It accommodates Hamas a little bit in that the language, I guess, is vague enough that they could sell this as a deal that could lead to a permanent or at least long-term resolution to the conflict. I don't want to downplay the significance of this. 60 days is 60 days. If there's an increase in humanitarian aid that comes in, that's great. There's, you know, if there's no fighting for 60 days, no bombs, no, constant airstrikes, that's good for the people of Gaza. But is this going to be a permanent end to the conflict? You know, assuming that it even comes together, it hasn't come together yet. People will, by the time anybody listens to this, it will either have come together or probably collapsed if it hasn't. But assuming it does come together, is it going to lead to a permanent cessation of hostilities? I have my strong doubts, let's say, because there's just no desire for that on the part of the Israeli government.
And there's also been expansion in the West Bank. Tell us about that.
This was on Thursday. The Israeli government announced the creation or the legalization, I guess you could say, of 22 new settlements. This is a shocking number, even by Israeli standards, across the West Bank, including, I think, a few very close to the Jordanian border. These kinds of expansions happen routinely. They especially have happened with some frequency under the current Israeli government, but 22 in one fell swoop is a pretty pretty big chunk of territory, pretty big chunk of settlements to do in one act. Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister in the Israeli government, who also has authority over West Bank settlements via his post in the defense ministry, basically said openly that, in addition to all the lovely settlements being legalized and all the people living there, and isn't that great, this is also going to prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state. This is, openly talked about in Israel. You won't necessarily find it reported that much in the United States, but this is what the government says out loud. And, it's not annexation. We're not at the point of annexation. It would be a whole nother diplomatic issue for the Israeli government to just openly annex the West Bank. But this kind of thing really does get us to much closer to a de facto annexation of the territory.
Thanks, Derek. All right, let's move on to Sudan, where there's been a spike in a cholera.
This has been reported, the Sudanese government reported it on Tuesday, that it had seen over the previous week 2,700 new cholera infections and 172 deaths. For context, the previous Tuesday, it said over the 3 weeks before that, 3 weeks, It had only seen 2,300 cases and 51 deaths. So clearly a spike is happening here. Most of it seems to be concentrated in Khartoum or in the Khartoum state, which includes the city of Khartoum itself, the capital of Sudan, at least by law, along with Omdurman and the city of Bahri or Khartoum North. All of that area, as we've talked about on the show, has been the epicenter of some pretty heavy fighting in the last couple of months as the Sudanese military has driven the Rapid Support Forces militant group out, I think entirely at this point. They still had one lingering foothold in sort of the outskirts of Omdurman, but I believe the Sudanese military has taken that as well. But that fighting has left the state basically without electricity, without basic utilities. The lack of electricity means you can't turn on water treatment facilities, which means people are going to the river and getting their water directly, which is how you get a spike in cholera cases. This is the kind of thing that's very difficult once it gets going. If you don't get in there and restore the services, restore the water treatment, get clean water to people, it can be very devastating and move very quickly. So I think it's definitely something to sort of sound the alarm about.
Let's move on to Libya, and let's talk about the Eastern government, which has discussed cutting off oil.
The Eastern government warned, and this is the government that's based in Benghazi. It's controls, or really is controlled by, the Haftar family, the Libyan National Army, that group. Those folks. It issued a statement on Wednesday warning that it may declare force majeure on the country's oil fields and ports. The LNA, the Haftar's militia, basically, that is nominally under control of the Eastern government, does have a presence at most of Libya's major oil facilities, so it can shut them down if it wants to. The ostensible reason for this is what the Eastern government called repeated assaults on the National Oil Corporation office in Tripoli. The National Oil Corporation, for what it's worth, said, we're functioning normally. There have been no assaults. We're not sure what what they're talking about. What this may be, and the reason that I wanted to mention it, is it may be the prelude to the Eastern government establishing its own national oil company, or its own competing version of the national oil company, located in a city that is under Eastern control, under Libyan National Army control. Right now, with the NOC in Tripoli, the Eastern government really does not have much control, if any, over that institution. It comes more under the government that's based in Tripoli, the Government of National Unity, which is the internationally recognized Libyan government, for whatever that's worth, and it's not much. So there, I think this has to send up some red flags in that the Eastern government may be moving to just sort of cut Tripoli out of the oil business entirely. Oil is the main economic lifeline in Libya. So shutting down the oil fields would be devastating to the Libyan economy. But it would be devastating across the board. It would hurt the Eastern government just as much as the Western. If the Eastern government establishes its own competing oil company to sell that oil, then it could continue to reap the benefits while cutting Tripoli out entirely, which I think is the kind of thing that could spark a resurgence of civil war if it were to happen. So I would be cautious about that.
Let's stay in the area and let's talk about South Sudan, where Salva Kiir has appointed a potential successor.
This is just following up. If people listened to Joshua Kraze's episode earlier this week, the interview that we did on South Sudan, he mentioned this, that Kiir, who is old, he's not in good health. He's 73, he's aged. He's not in good health. That he was
planning
to
name. Dude, he's a fucking whippersnapper in this country.
Yeah,
73.
Well,
give him
You're
three
right.
more terms.
put him on. One of the committees in the House. I guess make him the ranking member.
Let's make him the head of every committee.
Yeah, there you go. Joshua said, that he was planning to name a businessman named Benjamin Bulmel as the deputy chair of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, and thereby set him up as a potential successor or an heir apparent, kind of designated. That happened last week. It happened late last week. And It's been rumored for some time now that as I said, you know, Joshua talked about it, that Keir was going to do this, but it's also been rumored, and Joshua talked about this also in the interview, that this is not a popular move, even within, you know, kind of Keir's group of supporters, his Dinka ethnic group and kind of his base, that Bohmel is not universally, like, the decision to make Bohmel the, as I say, heir apparent is not universally supported. So we may see some tension emerge over this. We'll have to wait and see. But I thought it was, given the context of having just done Joshua's interview, I thought it was worth mentioning this since it happened after we recorded that.
Let's move on to Mozambique and talk about the jihadist activity that seems to be on the rise there.
There have been a number of attacks this month in what had been a relatively dormant jihadist movement. I mean, Mozambique, northern Mozambique, and particularly Cabo Delgado province has been plagued by jihadist activity, Islamic State activity, really, for months, couple of years, I think, at this point. The insurgency has been going on. But it had kind of subsided in recent months. There have been kind of regional interventions that had tamped things down. And the big thing was that the major offshore natural gas product that's been kind of brewing in Cabo Delgado, run by the French company Total Energies, was suspended. Total pulled out in 2021 and suspended the project due to jihadist violence. They are now ramping back up to resume that offshore gas project. And it seems that Islamic State fighters in the north, in Cabo Delgado, are also ramping up to try and stop it. And that's the source of this spike in attacks that we've seen in the last few weeks. There was one on Tuesday that left, according to Islamic State, 10 Mozambican soldiers dead. You know, IS, not the most reliable source, but local kind of sources that spoke to AFP said there were multiple soldiers killed. So, and that's just the latest of a series of attacks that have happened over the course of May. We've really seen a noticeable spike. So I think it seems pretty clear the correlation here is between the resumption of this offshore project and attacks from the Islamic State group there.
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
If you're an RIA, Schwab Advisor Services is the Watson to your homes. Smart, dependable, always has your back. With all the wealth services, technology, and support your firm needs, the difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Follow the clues at schwabvious.com.
Let's talk about this Mauritius United Kingdom Chagos Islands deal that was just signed.
Right. We've talked about this before. The UK and Mauritius have been negotiating a deal to return, or return is the way the Mauritian government puts it. It's unclear whether that's really the way to term it. But the Chagos Islands were the UK hung on to the Chagos Islands when Mauritius became independent. And the Mauritian government has long claimed that the Chagos Islands chain or that archipelago should be part of Mauritius. But when Britain kind of pulled out colonially from Mauritius and allowed that country to become independent, it hung on to these Chagos Islands, particularly because of the presence of the Diego Garcia military base, which the U.S. uses as the arguably the most important, largest overseas military base that the U.S. Possesses. So Britain refused to give the Chagos back, or refused to relinquish control over the Chagos, whether as an independent state or as part of Mauritius. But they've been kind of negotiating here for a while. The international legal system, to the extent that it matters, seems to favor the Mauritian claim here. And so the UK has been working from a place of what can we do to kind of preserve control over Diego Garcia, while, I guess, returning the giving the rest of these islands to Mauritius. And they reached an agreement late last year to hand over the Chagos to Mauritius while retaining Diego Garcia on a 99-year lease that was then interrupted partly by UK politics, partly by the US election, and, you know, questions over whether the Trump administration was going to feel comfortable about this, the U.S. having an effective veto over any deal because of Diego Garcia. But the Trump administration gave the agreement its backing earlier this year, and so the U.K. and Mauritius went ahead with it. They signed their agreement late last week. It is basically the terms that were announced last year. The Chagos Islands will become part of Mauritius. Diego Garcia will remain under British control and then effective U.S. control, given the military base, on this 99-year lease. There's a lot of concern, I think, among Chagosians about the fact that they're still not going to be allowed to return to Diego Garcia. Like, some of them can be repatriated, perhaps, to the Chagos Islands now that it's become part of Mauritius. But Diego Garcia is still going to remain off limits. And there are other terms that establish, you know, cordons around the islands. So, you know, the Mauritian government can't decide to start building anything on the nearby islands. It gives the UK the right to veto any foreign country that wants to do business in the Chagos get involved there, either in a civilian or military capacity. So there's a lot of conditions here that I think people are not necessarily comfortable with, but the UK seems to feel that this will satisfy its needs. And the Trump administration agrees. And after all, at the end of the day, isn't it really more important how the US and UK feel about this than anybody else?
I totally agree. I also love the 99-year lease. I wonder why that became a thing. Why not the century lease or the 101-year lease?
It's always like 99 years. It's the reason why gas is always, $4.99 instead of $5. Yeah.
What do they always say? Tell us in the comments, folks, if you know why it's a 99-year lease.
There you go.
All right. Let's move on to Russia, which has offered a new peace talks in its war with Ukraine.
Right. The Russian government proposed on Wednesday, I believe, that there should be a new round of peace talks to be held on Monday in Istanbul. The last round was held in Istanbul on May 16th. It says it has received no response from the Ukrainians to its generous offer to hold another round of talks that probably won't achieve anything. The Ukrainian government did respond somewhat obliquely. Their defense minister, Rustem Umerov, noted to reporters that Russia still hasn't fulfilled one of the obligations that came out of the May 16th discussion, which was that both countries agreed to draft a memorandum on peace, was how they termed it, that laid out, you know, their requirements for a potential peace deal, or their red lines, or, you know, just the terms of what they'd like to see in a peace settlement. And Ukraine has apparently done written its memorandum, sent it to Russia. The Russians have not written their memorandum, or at least haven't sent it to the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians say they're sort of waiting for the Russians to fulfill that obligation before they, I think, move on any new round of talks. There was a report in Reuters earlier this week suggesting that the Russians will demand, if or when they do write their memorandum, it will include a demand for a written pledge from NATO to stop expanding the alliance, at least among former Soviet republics, and to lift sanctions. And this is the analysis that I've seen is, you know, NATO's position on this has been consistent. They don't want to give the Russian government or Vladimir Putin veto rights over alliance expansion. But Putin at this point seems pretty comfortable just continuing the war indefinitely if he doesn't get what he wants. He seems to be pretty energized at this point to you know, not compromise. He's even back to demanding full sovereignty, recognized Russian sovereignty over the four mainland Ukrainian provinces that Russia partially occupies. In other words, you know, demanding not just recognition of the parts that the Russians control, but recognition of all that Russia controls all of those provinces, even the territories that are still directly administered by Ukraine. So, you know, he's clearly feeling his oats at this point and making very maximalist demands that I think, you know, are probably the first round in a negotiating process that he'll whittle down from there. But they're so maximalist that it's been, I think, somewhat off-putting and sort of stalled any further progress.
What do you think he's going to go for? I think he's going to be like zero NATO, and I don't think no Western troops, right? I think that's what it's going to be, like the things that he won't budge on.
I mean, he's going to demand Ukrainian neutrality, which,
right,
yeah, probably means no Western troops stationed on Ukrainian soil. I don't think the Ukrainians can agree to that. From a practical
certainly not
perspective,
much of a security guarantee.
Right. It's inviting another, you know, it's inviting an invasion, you know, another invasion 4 years from now or 2 years from now.
Or 15
and
years from
politically,
now. Whatever
or 15,
it is, yeah.
Yeah, whenever. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you assume that, you know, Vladimir Putin is not going to be with us for that much longer, and maybe things will change.
But he's a young, what, 75? How old is
Putin? Yeah. So, you know, it's that, you know, all those things have to factor into it, but, you know, just from, even from a political standpoint, I don't think Volodymyr Zelensky could agree to something like that without, you know, having to live, you know, with constant, under constant protection, from his own people. 'Cause that would be a huge capitulation. So that I think is going to be a real sticking point. The territory, I don't think is much of a sticking point, because they will eventually
already happening, right?
Compromise on de facto, like the territory that you have now is the territory that you
like
keep.
In World War II. Yeah.
Crimea,
you get that,
you know, right. There might be a recognition of Crimea in a legal sense. I don't think they'll get recognition of the mainland provinces, and they certainly won't get the parts of those provinces that Russia doesn't already control, parts of which would be indefensible anyway. I'm not even sure why, you know, Putin would necessarily want them. They'd be a headache, like in Kherson, the you know, the parts on the western bank of the river. I just don't know why he would even want them at this point, given the way things have settled out. I think that part is relatively easy. They'll get to that eventually, but the security guarantee,
that's going to be a sticking point.
The Ukrainians need, and I don't know how to implement it in a way that the Russians would be okay with it. That's going to be a difficult thing.
It's what we call a sticky situation. But do you know who isn't happy about this, Derek? That is President Donald John Trump. And I guess it's the reverse of Mueller time, because now he's yelling at Putin.
I mean, yeah, he's back to yelling at Putin after, you know, the peace talks that took place earlier this month, and Trump, you know, called Putin, and then he reported back to the Europeans that, like, Putin doesn't want to do anything and doesn't want to make a deal. And I'm really, you know, it's not my problem anymore. You guys figure it out. I'm not going to do sanctions, you know. And that was after he had spent several weeks talking about sanctions, after he met with Zelensky at the Pope's funeral and was very sympathetic to the Ukrainians all of a sudden. So he's really kind of lurching from thing to thing and reacting rather than kind of dictating terms, which, if you're trying to mediate a peace agreement, is not helpful, I think. He lurched back again this week to the Putin bad position. He went on social media on Tuesday to say that, you know, Putin is playing with fire, was the quote that he was, the thing he wrote. 2 days before, this was on Tuesday, 2 days before that, he said again via his little social media apparatus, that something has happened to Putin. He's gone absolutely crazy, and crazy was in all caps with an exclamation point, so you know he really meant it. So he's clearly upset. The weekend saw some of the worst Russian bombardments of Ukraine since the invasion began in 2022. The Saturday night into Sunday, drone, missile, et cetera, strikes were, according to the Ukrainians, the largest single night night and day of airstrikes or air assaults on Ukraine since the war began, or since the invasion, I should say. And so Trump was reacting to that. But as I said, he's just reacting to whatever he sees or whoever talks to him, you know, in the typical Trump pattern. But it's clear that whatever strategy he thought he had, or whatever process he thought he was going to follow to resolve this conflict when he took office, is now, you know, long since been tossed in the dumpster. And he's just lurching from thing to thing. Like, he has a conversation with somebody and that's the thing for that day. Or he sees, you know, some news about a major Russian airstrike and that's his thing for the day. And he's mad about that. Or he's, you know, back on Putin's side and we're not doing sanctions. He's talking about sanctions again. You know, since he posted these social media missives, he's now talking about doing sanctions again. This is after last week, no sanctions. And then the week before that, maybe we'll do sanctions. It's all a mess. And I think it contributes, instead of, you know, playing a role of trying to mediate a deal or calming things down, he's now contributing to the uncertainty and the level of, kind of chaos surrounding what is supposed to be a peace process. It's really not. But it making things worse at this point. It's not even a neutral thing. I think his behavior at this point is making the situation worse.
Never would have guessed that. Well, yeah. Derek, obrigado, and let's move on to Portugal, where a far-right party has emerged as the main opposition.
Right. I think we talked last week about Portugal's snap election that took place, that resulted in the re-election, I guess, of Prime Minister Luis Montenegro and his center-right Democratic Alliance bloc, which will maintain its minority government. The final results came in. The Democratic Alliance finished with control of 91 seats. It's 230-seat parliament, the Assembly of the Republic. So far short of a majority, but actually a little bit of an improvement on the position that Democratic Alliance was in going into the vote. But the big news with the final count is that Chega, the far-right party in Portugal, has emerged as the largest opposition bloc in parliament. It was kind of neck and neck in the vote totals and the voting results with the Socialist Party. But when they broke it out into seats, Chega took 60 seats. I think the Socialists actually finished slightly ahead of Chega in terms of vote count. But when they broke it out into parliamentary seats, Chega has 60 seats. The Socialists just only have 58 seats, which is the same number they had going into the election. Major development here for Chega to vault into position as the main opposition party, certainly, you know, indicative of a continued swing toward the far right in Portugal, and, you know, kind of continuing that trend across Europe, and something to keep an eye out for. It's really, Portugal, since the 1970s, has been in basically a two-party system, and they've broken that now with Chega's kind of surpassing the Socialists.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move over to Latin America, and let's talk about Colombia, where Gustavo Petro, the president, has called for a general strike.
Petro is frustrated. He's been frustrated his entire term. His legislative agenda has been blocked in an unfriendly Colombian Congress, and his term is up next year. There's going to be an election. He can't run for re-election legally. So he has taken to the streets. He called earlier this week for a general strike, a two-day general strike on Wednesday and Thursday. Thousands of people in cities across the country reportedly took him up on it on Wednesday. I haven't seen much reporting on the effects, but, you know, there were protests. There were instances in Bogota of people, you know, setting up flaming barricades, blocking streets, et cetera, et cetera. In particular, Petro is pushing a labor and healthcare reform package that is going nowhere in the legislature. What he wants is a national popular referendum on those measures and possibly on a raft of other things. I don't know how far he wants to go with it, but basically to go around Congress and appeal to the Colombian people. But to do that, you have to get legislative support for a referendum, which he's obviously not getting. And hence the tension. Petro is, I don't think, nearly as popular as he was when he was elected. Part of the reason for that is that his agenda has been stymied in the Congress, so he seemed somewhat ineffectual. Nevertheless, he still commands apparently a pretty sizable number of people, especially in the cities. So we'll see if this leads to anything. I suspect not, but it's certainly worth paying attention to.
All right, Derek, let's turn to the greatest country on the goddamn earth, and that is the United States. And let's start with Trump freezing student visas.
The administration announced earlier this week that it was suspending the process of issuing student visas while it implements what it calls expanded social media vetting for applicants. So if anybody's out there in another country and is really desperate to study in the United States, though, frankly, why would you be at this point? My advice is to scrub your feeds on X, the Everything app, or Facebook, or wherever you post your political screeds, and say nice things about Donald Trump. Say nice things about the U.S. government. Don't say anything that could be construed as criticism of the state of Israel. And you'll probably be okay once they implement this expanded social media vetting. Though, as I say, my question at this point is why anybody would still be interested in studying in the United States if you don't have to, or even coming really to the United States. And there's evidence, for example, that tourism is down enough that European airlines are pulling back flights to the U.S., to and from the U.S. So people are clearly getting the message that this is not a friendly government to travelers. Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, then announced on Wednesday that the U.S. is going to just flat out start revoking visas from Chinese students, particularly in what he called critical fields. The administration, in keeping with its views on tariffs and pretty much every other interaction that the U.S. has with a country abroad, seems to think that the process here is these Chinese students come to the U.S. and like steal something when they study at Harvard or, any other university. They're like taking some knowledge away from the United States, taking it back to China, where it would be used for nefarious purposes by the Chinese Communist Party. That's, of course, not how it works. It's not how tariffs work either. But, that's the attitude here, is that we've got some finite supply of education or intelligence that's being pilfered by our enemies. So they're going to just start pulling visas from Chinese students, which, you look at this and think about like some of the load-bearing soft power pillars of U.S. empire. One of the big ones is that we suck in smart, educated people from all over the world. That's out now. Another one is tourism, that people like for whatever reason to come to the United States and experience the joyous society that we have here. That's apparently out. As I said, you've got airlines cutting flights to the U.S. because people don't want to come here anymore. These are two pretty big soft power pillars that we've just kind of taken a sledgehammer to. I think it's interesting to watch them do this, and we'll see what the effects are.
All right, Derek, let's talk about Liberation Day, which has been canceled.
Sadly, it's been canceled. Yeah, I know. People were really excited about it. The U.S. Court of International Trade ruled on Wednesday that the glorious Liberation Day tariffs are unconstitutional. The Trump administration had cited the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, which gives the president the authority for brief periods of time in a national emergency to impose tariffs without going to Congress for approval. It had cited this act to impose sweeping, open-ended, massive tariffs on pretty much every country in the world. And shockingly, the court ruled that the act did not envision those kinds of tariffs being covered under the emergency economic powers that it bestowed upon the president.
It's like, it just doesn't mean you could do tariffs against every country in the world, I think is what something like that. It was like,
yes,
this is a clear
exactly.
expansion of the authority of this act. Yeah.
So, to do that, they argued the president has to go to Congress because Congress has the power of the purse. For the time being, at least, Liberation Day is canceled. The administration will surely appeal. Who knows how that will go? And then if the appeal doesn't go its way, it may just ignore the court order and try to collect duties anyway. That would be difficult. I think there's a lot of mechanisms that would have to go into collecting duties that are, it's different than ignoring, say, a court order to get a guy out of prison, the prison that you dumped him into in El Salvador, which you can just not do and say, well, you, screw you. There's a little more to it in this case, but they may try anyway. Who knows?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they have the political will to go through on this, because it was so unpopular and he reversed so many of them so quickly.
Yes, I don't know if you saw, like, he got asked, there's apparently an acronym, TACO, Trump always chickens out.
He goes, I kick out, he said he didn't hear it at first.
It's become popular on Wall Street because he keeps, you know, announcing these tariffs and then, you know, pulling them back immediately. He did it with Liberation Day. There was another, there was an instance in the last few days where he said he's going to impose a 50% tariff on the European Union. And then immediately, like a day later, said, well, I'm not going to do it until July. And, you know, and then in July, he'll probably come up with another reason not to do it. The acronym is Trump Always Chickens Out. And he got really mad. He got asked about it earlier this week and got really mad at the reporter, you know, who was just asking him about a thing that people are saying about him. But he got really mad at the reporter for even suggesting that he always chickens out. And yet, this stuff just kind of comes and goes on the day. He rolls some chicken bones or something and figures out what his tariff policy is going to be for that day. And we go from there.
I love that we've just had two incredibly ornery old men as our president for quite a while now. It's good stuff. It's going to be more than a decade. All right, Derek, this is actually an interesting one, which I think raises important questions about how to analyze Trump and, you know, not jumping the gun too quickly. But Jake, put in maybe, I don't know, taps something melancholy here, because
something very melancholy.
Elon Musk's time as co-president, quote unquote, has come to an end.
He flew too close to the sun on wings of wax, I guess. Elon announced on Wednesday, and this has been building for a while. He's been saying, I should probably spend more time with my companies, and I'm not going to donate as much money to political campaigns anymore as I've done in the past. So it's been building for a while, but he announced on Wednesday that he's leaving the Department of Government Efficiency and his role in the administration. Partly this is a legal thing. He was appointed as a special government employee, which gives you only a limited amount of time in which you serve in that capacity. That expired. Of course, there would have been ways to keep him around had he wanted to, or had the feeling been mutual.
No, the parliamentarian said no.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, yeah, they just, gosh, there's nothing we can do about this. There have been murmurings, like, you know, sort of anonymous reporting from within the Trump administration that they didn't want anything more to do with him.
That everyone fucking hates him and he's not funny.
And everybody hates him. He's awkward.
It must be so horrible to be in a room with someone who's not funny and who keeps on making jokes.
That he's the funniest guy in the room.
Yeah. It's the worst thing that could happen to a person. I can't imagine having to deal with that for months on end.
Especially when he is the richest man alive and, you know, can afford to to be in any room, basically.
He's a genius.
Musk, you know, made a little post on X, the Everything app, where he, you know, said that his scheduled time as a government employee is over, and thanked President Trump for giving him the opportunity to reduce wasteful spending, which he didn't really do, because if you look at the big, beautiful budget that Trump has proposed, it's going to massively explode the debt or the deficit and therefore the debt. Musk actually criticized the big, beautiful budget bill. I'm using Trump's terms here, the big, beautiful budget bill. Actually criticized the bill publicly for its effect on the national debt, or its expected effect on the national debt, a few days ago, which may have just been the final kind of, nail in the coffin as far as their relationship is concerned. Trump dismissed his criticism to reporters, didn't seem to be too perturbed about it, but who knows behind the scenes, you know, how much tension there is. You know, clearly we're not going to get any more days where Trump turns the White House into a Tesla showroom and we have cars all over the lawn and we're showing them off to reporters, which is just a high point, I think, in American history in general.
Deal with loser energy, right? Like I always thought this was not going to last because he can't deal with loser energy. And like, you could be the richest guy in the world, but you still have that energy.
Yeah. I mean, it took him a while. It took him longer, I think, to pick up on that.
120 days, a little more.
Because of the money, because Musk is the richest guy in the world and Trump instinctively not only respects that, but wants to cower before it, it took him longer than it might otherwise to pick up on the fact that this guy is just a fucking loser. But I think they're at that point now.
Well, Derek, I think this suggests that maybe we should hold off on doing things like claiming someone is a co-president with someone like Donald Trump. But that's just me. Anyone. Anyway,
he had his time as co-president. It's over, and we can move on.
We loved it, folks. Well, everyone, thank you so much for listening. Again, please do subscribe to the podcast, and at the very least, rate and review it on Apple. We need a couple hundred more to get above 1,000, and I think we could do it. So again, thank you for listening, and as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.